Welcome to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site HCP Live. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Before we introduce our guest today, just a reminder that Lungcast is available on all your favorite streaming platforms. Subscribe to @Lungcast on YouTube to get new and archived episodes, as well as interview segments from episode highlights as they come out. A link to the show page, as well as the ALA and HCP Live homepages for Lungcast, can be found in each episode description. For those of you who prefer a podcast, you can subscribe to Lungcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening platforms. You can also register for more respiratory news and insights at both lung.org and hcplive.com. Our guest today is Dr. John Balmes, who is Professor of Medicine Emeritus at the University of California, San Francisco, and Professor of Environmental Health Sciences Emeritus in the School of Public Health at the University of California, Berkeley. He serves as an attending physician in the Division of Occupational, Environmental, and Climate Medicine at UCSF and at the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine at San Francisco General Hospital. Dr. Balmes has studied the effects of exposures to occupational agents and air pollution on respiratory, immune, cardiovascular, and metabolic health, and has collaborated on studies of indoor and outdoor air pollution, as well as wildfire smoke, for many years. He has also served as the physician member of the California Air Resources Board since 2008, and is a valued advisor and volunteer national medical spokesperson for the American Lung Association. Dr. Balmes, thank you for your time and effort over the years, especially today as we discuss our State of the Air Report 2024.
Thank you, Dr. Rizzo. I'm glad to be here.
The American Lung Association each year releases our State of the Air Report, which is an annual air quality report card that tracks individuals' exposures in cities nationwide to unhealthy levels of ground-level ozone or smog and particle pollution or soot over the course of a three-year time frame. The report also publishes a ranking of the most polluted and cleanest U.S. cities for air quality. American Lung Association just released the 25th Annual State of the Air Report. I know Dr. Balmes have been involved with this report as a reviewer of the health effects section for many years. How long would you say you've been working with this report?
Well, I think this is at least the fourth edition that I've helped with the health effects section.
And you're a good one to do that based on your background that I just read. So for more background on our list for our listeners, the State of the Air Report uses recent quality assured air pollution data from county measuring stations collected by official federal, state, local, and tribal governments during the years 2020, 2021, and 2022. The year delay in reporting is necessary to collect accurate and validated data from these various agencies. Now, regrettably, out of the 3,221 counties in the United States, only about 911 counties, or less than one-third, actually can monitor for at least one pollutant. That means there are more than 71 million people who live in counties where their ozone and particle pollution levels are not being monitored. And as we will discuss, that can have health consequences. On my review of this year's report, the 2024 report shows that people in the U.S. experienced more days with very unhealthy and hazardous air quality because of particle pollution than in the history of the report dating back to 25 years. Dr. Balmes, can you please give your views on what some of the causes are that lead to increases and periodic spikes in particle pollution? And in view of the years that are being covered, please especially comment on the effects, if any, of the pandemic and, of course, the various wildfire outbreaks that have been occurring over the last several years.
Yeah, there are several reasons for why particle pollution is worse in many of the cities that the report covers. So I'll start with wildfires because I live in California and Northern California, where we've had a lot of experience with wildfires. And this has been widely publicized, but all the progress that we've made in recent years with the Clean Air Act enforcement, with reducing particle pollution from the usual sources like diesel trucks, coal-fired power plants, they have been almost eliminated. The benefit has almost been eliminated by the incredible increase in particle pollution from wildfire smoke. And it's not just the Mountain West where I live, where the wildfires generally occur. The prevailing winds push the wildfire smoke across to the East Coast. A few years ago, I was interviewed by a New York radio station because the air quality was bad because of California wildfire smoke. And of course, this year, there's been the Canadian wildfire smoke that has actually impacted the East Coast. We had a relatively good year in California this year. So that's one reason. Another reason is that, as we're going to talk about, I think, later in the podcast, the US EPA has determined that there should be a stricter standard, national ambient air quality standard for PM particle pollution. And that means that more cities no longer have healthy air.
Right.
I would say those are the two main reasons why we have so many cities that are getting a bad score this year.
Right. So the main particle pollution we measure is the PM2.5, and we know it can have numerous health effects, especially when it's inhaled. Can you describe some of these health effects and comment on what populations may be at most risk for these effects?
Sure. So I should say that PM2.5 stands for fine particles, or particles that are smaller than 2.5 microns. Now, how small is that? Well, a human hair is about 60 microns. So we're talking about 2.5 versus 60. They're very small. These particles, when inhaled, make it down into the deep lung. And that fraction of those fine particles includes even smaller particles called ultrafine particles, which can go across the alveolar capillary membrane between the air sacs and the bloodstream, and then circulate around the body. So these fine particles cause problems for people with lung disease, especially people with asthma or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Exacerbations can occur from inhalation of PM2.5. But also, those ultrafine particles can get into the systemic circulation and affect the heart. They also kind of can get to the brain. There's now evidence that PM2.5 pollution is associated with dementia, risk of dementia, and on the other end of the life course, cognitive development of kids. We know more about the respiratory and cardiovascular effects of PM. There's increased risk of death due to cardiovascular events like heart attacks and stroke, but we're learning more about these effects on the nervous system of the brain. There's also increased risk for metabolic disorders like diabetes related to PM2.5. So the more we investigate the health effects of PM2.5, the more we find. And that's why the EPA lowered the standard, made it stricter.
Got it.
Now, and the groups of people that are most susceptible are the very old, who usually have pre-existing heart and lung disease, but not always. The very young, so infants that are whose lungs are growing, they may not grow to what they would have if the infant had been in a clean environment. I've already mentioned younger people, middle-aged people with pre-existing lung disease, especially asthma and COPD, and then people with pre-existing cardiovascular disease. And the final group is low-income communities of color have a greater burden of exposure to PM2.5 because of where they live. And they also may be at increased risk for other factors outside of the air pollution, like they don't have good diets because they live in a food desert. They don't have access to green space. And they may not get as good healthcare access. So that's an area that's really important right now, is the interaction between air pollution exposure and other factors that impact people's health.
Right. So I think you alluded to this earlier, but this year's report does reflect the new annual particle pollution standard that the EPA finalized this past February. So for our listeners, on February 7th, the EPA put forward a revised primary annual PM2.5 National Air Quality Standard, or NAAQS. And this strengthened the standard from 12 micrograms per cubic meter down to 9 micrograms per cubic millimeter. Thanks to this new stronger standard, we now recognize that the number of people living in places with unhealthy levels of annual particle pollution has gone from 18.8 million in last year's report to a large increase to 90.7 million this year. Can you comment again on the important implications of these new standards and why the American Lung Association has been advocating for stronger measures? And why is there a separate measure of short-term versus annual PM2.5 exposure?
Yeah, there's a lot there, but I'll start with the Clean Air Act, which empowers the US EPA to come up with these national ambient air quality standards, requires that there be review of the scientific literature every 5 years for the so-called criteria pollutants like PM and ozone. And as I've alluded to, research keeps coming out showing effects at lower and lower levels. And there's actually an abundance of research studies to support that there's an increased risk of death, mostly due to cardiovascular disease, below 12 micrograms per meter cubed. That's the annual standard. So the EPA determined, they do this very carefully, they do a risk assessment. They determined that lives would be saved, enough lives would be saved to justify a stricter standard going from 12 to 9. Now that's for long-term or chronic exposure. The short-term standard wasn't changed. That's 35 micrograms per meter cubed. Some of us would like to see that lowered too. But the EPA felt that the scientific literature wasn't strong enough to support lowering from 35 to, let's say, 30 micrograms per meter cubed. And on bad air days around the country, it's not just in California, though we have some of the worst air in certain cities in the country, you get levels higher than 35 micrograms per meter cubed, especially if there's a wildfire that's affecting the air quality. And it's not just wildfires. Wind-blown dust is an increasing problem with drought due to climate change in California and other Western states. And even though surface dust isn't necessarily as toxic as diesel exhaust particles, if you've been in a windstorm, you know that it can affect your ear. Respiratory health. So the reason that there are two is that there's a different set of studies that support long-term health effects versus short-term health effects. I personally think that there's enough evidence of short-term effects that the 24-hour 35 microgram meter cubed NAAQS should be lowered. Maybe next time.
Let's hope so. We'll advocate for that.
Yeah, the Lung Association did actually advocate for a lower
standard. I know you've spoken a number of times at the EPA for pushing these standards, and thank you for that. So as I mentioned earlier, the report measures both the particle pollution that we've been talking about and also ozone pollution. Now, this year's report shows significant improvements in ozone pollution, thanks in large part to what we've already mentioned, the longstanding Clean Air Act. And again, for our listeners' background, that Act was passed in 1970 and then strengthened with some subsequent amendments in the following years that has become a really comprehensive federal law that regulates all sources of air emissions. The 1970 Clean Air Act authorized the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to establish the National Ambient Air Quality Standards that Dr. Bums mentioned, and to protect public health and the environment. And ground-level ozone and particulate matter are considered two of the criteria pollutants, the others being carbon monoxide, sulfur, and nitrogen dioxide, and lead. Now, despite the improvement in this year's report, unfortunately, we still see that there's 131 million people living in places with unhealthy ozone levels. Dr. Boms, please remind our listeners of the adverse health effects of exposure to unhealthy levels of ozone pollution, and what are the main causes of unhealthy ground-level ozone?
Yeah, so ozone was really the first pollutant that got people's attention in terms of public health, and Los Angeles was the poster child city with bad smog, and the pollutant of most concern in smog is ozone. And ozone, when you inhale it, can actually burn the lungs chemically. It's, you know, a very potent oxidant chemical, unstable, and it likes to attach to whatever it can, including our airways. So it especially can affect people with asthma. You know, people with asthma already have inflammation of their airways. And when they inhale ozone, they get, you know, the chemical burn on top of their baseline inflammation. So they have more inflammation and they get exacerbations of their disease. On smoggy days, you'll see more people with asthma showing up in emergency rooms. There are also chronic effects of ozone, especially people with pre-existing respiratory disease of all types. There's increased risk of respiratory death. Particulate matter is mostly cardiovascular in terms of mortality risk. Ozone, it's more respiratory risk. So we've done a good job in general of reducing the precursors to ozone. Ozone's a secondary pollutant. It forms in the atmosphere, mostly from tailpipe emissions. And, you know, we started smog controls in California in 1967, before the US EPA even started. But thanks to the Clean Air Act, and California keep pushing ahead of the Clean Air Act, motor vehicles are producing much less ozone precursors. It's actually oxides of nitrogen that in the atmosphere form ozone. Unfortunately, climate change is putting our success at risk in terms of ozone, because ozone levels in the atmosphere are directly related to temperature. So the hotter it gets, the more ozone, you know. So cities like Atlanta, Houston, actually have a lot of ozone now. They, you know, rival Los Angeles in terms of ozone levels. So we have to keep working to control emissions of precursors of ozone. And again, motor vehicles are the worst, but natural gas-fired power plants are the second worst, because they generate oxides of nitrogen, which then can form ozone.
Yeah, you kind of anticipated my next question, but what are some of the measures that an individual and also organizations like the American Lung Association can advocate for to help keep moving these levels in the right direction?
Yeah, so I think the most important thing to do as individuals is to try to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. So electrifying, you know, our motor vehicles, electrifying our home appliances are the big things we can do as individuals, because that will reduce both particle pollution from fossil fuel combustion, but also precursors for ozone. Right. Yeah, so we need clean transportation, clean power generation. The Lung Association has been a standout in terms of advocating for clean air, common sense clean air regulations, and I know it will continue to do so. The Lung Association is also trying to mobilize people to understand the intersection between climate change and air quality. We can have co-benefits if we reduce our reliance on fossil fuels in our society and economy. That'll mitigate climate change by reducing CO2 emissions, but it will also improve public health by improving air quality.
So in addition to measuring these levels of ozone and particulate matter and ranking the worst and best areas, and you alluded to this earlier as well, the ALA is very concerned about the inequities that exist regarding poor air quality exposure. We know that communities of color are disproportionately exposed to unhealthy air, likely in part because of socioeconomic and historically racist policies such as redlining, and that people of color are also more likely to be living with one or more chronic conditions that may make them more vulnerable to the health impact of air pollution, as you mentioned as well, including asthma, diabetes, and heart disease. Can you comment on what this year's report tells us about the inequities that exist?
Yes, one of the things I like about this year's report, there's more of a focus on the inequities. And this is factual. This is not me being on a soapbox.
Right.
We know that low-income communities of color in general across the country have a greater burden of exposure to air pollution, especially PM 2.5, especially from diesel vehicles and from coal-fired power plants. And there's really no question about it. So what we're trying to do in California is address local hotspots of air pollution in those communities because the national ambient air quality standards from the US EPA are about regional air quality. They actually put the air quality monitoring stations away from freeways, you know, away from power plants, away from ports and rail yards on purpose because they want to get the region's air quality. What we're doing in California, and I think, you know, other states as well are moving in this direction, is to try to do community level monitoring, to actually put monitors where the hotspots of exposure are. So just to give an example, you know, I live in Berkeley, California, and just up the road a piece from Berkeley is Richmond, California, where there is a confluence of several large freeways, busy freeways, a rail yard, a port, and a refinery. And so people that live in West Richmond get exposure from all those sources. There's no question that they have a disproportionate burden of exposure. And as you mentioned, they may have other risks for poor health outcomes. So what we're doing in California, it's a state law that mandates that the California Air Resources Board, part of Cal EPA, actually assist certain communities that have been identified as being particularly disadvantaged by air pollution exposure to do community monitoring and then come up with community emission reduction plans. I think that's where we need to go as a nation. You know, our air quality is better than it was in 1970 when the Clean Air Act was passed. But not everybody has equally benefited from that cleaner air.
Yeah, just to date myself, I remember a television series called L.A. Law. Opening credits always was the landscape of Los Angeles, the skyscrapers. And if you look at that now and compared to some recent pictures of L.A., we've made a big progress in the look of that smog that enveloped the city. Yeah, great transition there. The what I want to do for some closing comments, can you consider the role of climate change based on your expert perspective as a physician and a researcher? And how would you describe the changes in air quality that have occurred the last 25 years of our report? And what might you speculate on in the next 25 years? So when the 2049 State of the Air report comes out, you may or may not be surprised as to what it shows.
Well, I think we can continue the progress we've made if we double down on trying to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, both for transportation and power generation. We need to do that to keep global warming from totally getting out of control. If we do that, and we can, there are a number of studies from very solid economists to show that it's possible for us to move forward to reduce fossil fuel combustion without destroying our economy. And it's a heavy lift, but it's totally doable if we really put our minds to it. And when I say our minds, I mean collective, not just the US, but especially all the developed countries around the world. And if we do that, we'll also improve air quality. So I hope in 25 years, if I'm still around, which
let's hope so,
beyond likely because I'd be 100, I'd like to see that we did do the heavy lifting to reduce our combustion of fossil fuels, so reduce CO2 emission, mitigate climate change, and improve air quality.
Right. Well, I want to thank you again today for the time you've spent and also for the volunteer work you keep doing with the American Lung Association. It's very much appreciated.
Well, I'd like to give a shout out to you, Dr. Rizzo, because, you know, I've been a Lung Association volunteer for a long time, as have you. And
well, thank you.
I appreciate
We're in this together.
Yeah. It's a team.
Yep, absolutely. So for our listeners, if you want to hear more regarding air quality and its effect on health, as well as the interplay with climate change, we have a great archive of discussions on our show feeds, including with Dr. Mark Hernandez, Dr. Edward Brooks, and Dr. Charlene McAvoy regarding indoor air quality, and also Dr. Alan Greenglass and Dr. Pune Sabiri on air quality, climate change, and health impacts. So be sure again to subscribe and rate Lungcast on your preferred listening or watching platform, and visit lung.org and hcplive.com for more news and resources. Until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.